All right, thanks everybody. Thanks for coming. I'm going to talk a little bit about, we've had a good session so far, a great session actually, talking some about the social implications of adoption, some about the breeding, and I'm going to maybe talk about something that kind of justifies or leads to why we're interested in doing this work in the first place, and in the context of ecosystem services and these grain crops. So this work was done in Michigan State when I was a postdoc in Sig Snap's lab. And in some ways it built on work before that even, when I was a PhD student working with the Land Institute, with Jerry Glover and others. And in that context, we were looking at kind of comparing soil food webs, nutrient cycling, nutrient stocks between harvested native perennial grasslands versus annual croplands. And we found pretty different, in that study, we found pretty different functions and mechanisms for cycling of those nutrients. And kind of one of the main conclusions was the presence of these perennial roots, these really extensive rooting systems and the long-lived nature of them, capturing more photosynthetic energy over the course of a growing season, had pretty profound below-ground implications in terms of how energy and nutrients flow through these systems. So, you know, this is a striking photo for a number of reasons, but it really makes us think about the allocation of energy, NPP, into the below-ground system, how this carbon, which is fixed, you know, above-ground, of course, and translocated below-ground, feeding the entire system that really achieves or helps achieve or what we'd like to achieve as a model for an agroecosystem. So we can think about perennials as a natural systems as a model for what our ag systems want to be. Natural systems are characterized by tightly regulated processes, minimal losses of nutrients typically. In contrast, annual agroecosystems experience much greater losses of nutrients, primarily, well, first of all, there's a harvest component, but also there's some internal inefficiency cycling that happens there. There's losses, of course, through nitrogen leaching. There's denitrification losses that are large. And there's an overall lack of synchrony with nutrient supply and crop demand. So, you know, just as an example here, not surprising to anyone here, you know, maybe annual crops exhibit around a 50% nitrogen use efficiency. So we've spent decades in agronomic research trying to tweak management that we could essentially make our cropping systems more efficient, more sustainable, right? So some of these things include minimizing soil disturbance. Some of them include maximizing plant cover. And then a whole suite of work looking at manipulating fertilizer, the rates, the sources, the timing, and technologies. Despite all this, you know, things, there's definitely been a lot of good work that's, you know, advanced the sustainability of these systems, but there's, in a lot of ways, a lot of disadoption by growers or lack of adoption by growers. So a different approach, of course, that we've been talking about here is just this idea of perennial grain crops, okay? So we've heard a little bit about this. I don't need to go too much into it, but it is interesting when you ask a breeder to describe or give characteristics of what intermediate wheatgrass is versus somebody like me, which I consider myself an agronomist. But I'm not going to tell you anything about that it's Hexaploid. But I am going to tell you that it's a cool season grass. It's a highly palatable forage. It's a good quality forage that's grown very commonly in the Great Plains and in Intermountain West regions. And here's just some more pictures in case you're interested in seeing what it's like in terms of the seed. Here's the seed head. These are somewhat outdated pictures, but it's the general frame or generally what it looks like in terms of the forage. It is one of the things I think, from an agronomic perspective, why this crop is a really promising crop is that it's a pretty voracious sod former. This could potentially be a problem, but in the context of weed management, it's really nice. This is some intermediate wheatgrass grown in Michigan, and then they were grown in foot, you know, single plants that were grown in a foot, and then the second year that had completely filled in at that point. So. And then also really important from a breeding perspective is that there's just large genotypic and phenotypic variation that we can exploit. So that's an interesting or an important characteristic. So the field site for the study that I'm going to talk about first is here in Hickory Corners, Michigan, at the Kellogg Biological Station, which is a field station for Michigan State. And one of the things that we were really interested in is, you know, there's a lot of talk about what perennials or what a perennial grain system can or can't do, but there's really not much information, not much data actually showing the potential, right? So we can kind of, we can deduce what perennials do in natural systems, or we can deduce what forage systems, how those cycle nutrients, and then kind of extrapolate to a perennial system. But we thought it was important just to kind of collect some basic field data. So it was one of the primary drivers of this study. A two-way full factorial with three managements, which is essentially a nitrogen gradient. So this was provided by money through OREI grant, Organic Research Education Initiative. So we had an organic treatment, which received 80 pounds of N total, and maybe 60% of that was available first season. 80 pounds in the form of urea, and then 50% more than that with this high-end conventional. This is low-end, but we just call it low-end. It's pretty much 80 to 90 pounds is what would be recommended as the nitrogen rate in this region. Then we had an annual wheat comparison as our check, and then intermediate wheatgrass. This is third generation of this Kearns. And I guess I failed to mention that intermediate wheatgrass, the Land Institute has coined the word Kearns as kind of the trademark name for their developing line of intermediate wheatgrass. So so I'll probably be using those words interchangeably. But this was planted in the fall of 2009, and then we collected data for 4 years on it. Okay. We were kind of interested in some key agronomic functions related to nitrogen. So we looked at nitrogen leaching, soil N retention, soil water usage, and then carbon, looking at both total carbon root biomass and some lay-by fractions of carbon. And then we measured up to five different depth intervals down to a meter. We also looked at some soil food webs, and I'm not going to be talking about that today, so I just wanted to mention that. In terms of we had some interesting weather, as you've probably all experienced the last few years. So in 2010 was characterized as a warm, dry spring. 11, a cool, wet spring. 12, of course, 2012 in the Midwest was a hot and wet very early, but then the faucet just turned off, and it was one of the worst droughts that we've seen here in the last 25 years. And then 13 was maybe an average year. Okay, so this is the field site. We were limited by seed, so the plots were smaller than we really would have liked. But we have, I just showed this because this is in April 2010. So this is, we planted in November, and it was a late planting, unfortunately. But you can see, say, in this plot right here, which is intermediate wheatgrass, it was very kind of poor emergence in general. But the plant is kind of interesting in the context where it will emerge, and then it seems to just kind of hang out for a little bit, and it doesn't really grow that much. I think it's putting a lot of resources below ground, and then at some point it just kind of takes off. And this is, you know, I'm talking about in the first year. Of course, once that establishment year is over, then it remains kind of a sod form. So. And then here I'm just taking, we had a TDR probe to look at soil moisture, but I just wanted to show another picture here in terms of the total cover we had. This is early in the season, so it was pretty, not what would you consider a ideal stand establishment in terms of the first planting. So This is soil moisture data from that TDR probe. Okay, so we had a PVC pipe down to a meter installed, and we took measurements every 20 centimeters here. So our 2 years, 2010 and 2011, sorry, that font's pretty small. And then our four depths, 0 to 20, 20 to 40, 40 to 70, and 70 to 100. The blue is our perennial, and the red is our annual. So what we can see pretty clearly that in terms of total soil moisture and water use, the perennials are using essentially more soil moisture, soil water, okay? Now, 2010 was a little bit of a drier year than 2011, so we see larger differences in this establishment year. Okay. So in terms of nitrate concentration, we installed suction lysimeters and measured nitrate, how much nitrogen kind of was lost below the rooting zone. The lysimeters were installed about a meter and a half deep. And we can see this first year, there are some trends that emerge. These are four years, 2010 through 13, and then we've got this high nitrogen, recommended nitrogen, and then this organic treatment. So really this first year, there was no significant differences, but in the second year is really where we see huge differences in terms of total nitrate lost, okay? I'm sorry, this is actual concentration of nitrate that's in that leach shape. 2012, there was very little water that came out the bottom of those systems because of the drought. And then 2013, interestingly, we don't really see a large increase in nitrogen like I would expect here. And there's a few reasons that might, because of that, we had a lot of water in 2013, so that might just be a dilution effect. Or it might be because of the lack of productivity in 2012 that just reduced the rate of crop residue mineralization. Okay, so this is just concentration of nitrate. We need to take that and combine that with soil drainage rates to get kind of a total nitrate loss on a kilogram per hectare basis. Okay, and that's what this is. This is using a Salas model to take our nitrate concentrations in that lysimeter and then model essentially crop water uptake and soil drainage. This is just for the first 2 years. We have not done this yet for the last 2 years, so I don't really know what we're going to find. But I suspect it's going to, you know, there's no reason to believe that we're not going to see more of the same. But from 2010 to 2011, or April 2010 to October 2011, you can see that first year there's not, you know, very large differences. This is cumulative nitrate leach between the three managements. But it's after that second year, say sometime around between January and April, we see a lot of nitrate that comes out the bottom here. So what that means in terms of numbers, I spared you the tables here. But what we saw is essentially in that second year, we get a 85 to 99% reduction in nitrate in the second year. Now these are characterized as sandy loams, but they're pretty sandy soils, so we would think that these are soils that are typically prone to leaching to begin with. But still you can see, I mean, it's a pretty dramatic reduction in nitrate leaching that second year. So why is it nitrate leaching out these systems? Well, one of the reasons is likely, and you know, the working hypothesis is that the roots, right? This is why we're interested in perennials in the first place. And so this is data from Christine Sprunger, grad student in SIG's lab. And we can see that the different years, 11, 12, 13, and we can see, large, large differences, 6-7 times the amount of total root biomass. And interestingly, if you look at this, she looked at it both through coarse root fraction and fine root fraction. And those differences persist over both of those fractions. So there's some interesting trends that are emerging with these data, but this is kind of just the greatest hit slide. In terms of the root-to-shoot ratio, we can see in 2012 the lack of the drought basically really limited above-ground productivity, and we got, you know, these large relative ratio of above-ground shoots. So, and it wasn't until actually 2013 did we see this effective management, okay? So obviously, the difference between an annual and a perennial species, or annual grain and perennial grain, have and this is true throughout most of this work, is far trumped any kind of differences we see in this nitrogen gradient. So soil carbon, we saw after 2 years, essentially that first year, so we planted in November 2009, and in June of 2011, we saw differences in some of these labile fractions of active organic matter. Okay, so this is a short burst mineralization assay. We could detect differences there. After 4 years, we did not see any differences in total carbon, nor did we see any differences in a more stable fraction. Although it's a labile fraction of organic matter, this active carbon or permanganate oxidizable carbon, were no differences found. So again, you know, we have to, when we're thinking about sequestration capability of perennials, we need to consider soil type, right? Texture is really, really important, driving the ability of soils to sequester carbon. These are sandier soils, so they have less of a chance of essentially, they take longer in terms of storing carbon, they have less capacity to store carbon. So on different site, we might, you know, I just want to point out that we might find different scenarios here depending on the site we're at. And this is just one site. So the slide everybody wants to see, what do the yields look like? We've got a 2010 here, annual and perennial. So our first year, the establishment year, there were pretty terrible yields. The second year, we got up to roughly a third of what, you know, up to 1,500 pounds per acre, kilograms per hectare. So this was a really productive, great year. 2012, the drought really, really hurt our yields. And then I was expecting, interestingly, in 2013, we had a pretty favorable growing conditions. I was expecting this plant really to rebound. But we got the above-ground biomass, but we just did not see it in terms of the grain. And so this is something that we've, Lee DeHaan has observed in Kansas. We've seen this in Michigan and another a few other sites, and it's been elsewhere. After 3 or 4 years, we can see, with this wheatgrass, we can see some pretty significant declines in grain yield. And whether that be because it's becoming sod-bound or, you know, there's different theories about why that is, but we're really interested in trying to see if we can mitigate some of this decline through management, and that's one of the things that, you know, that I'll be talking about here in just a bit. So I guess I will point out, in case you've been looking at this table, this is actual total above ground biomass here. No, that's not right. Actually, this is the vegetative component of it, right? So you can see in 2011 we had average yields over 1,500 kilograms per hectare in terms of, or 15,000 kilograms per hectare in terms of total biomass, which these are very productive, you know, very productive plants, on the order of what we'd find in these sites in switchgrass or some of these other kind of native grasses. So to summarize, soil moisture had reduced soil moisture at lower depths than currents. So we don't know if this is really a fact of that moisture just not getting to that profile, or if it's because the surface roots of that perennial grass capture that before it actually has a chance to trickle down, or if it's because the roots are actually accessing it at greater depth. I mean, we think logically it's probably a little bit of both that's happening there, but we didn't explicitly test that. There are, you know, large differences in nitrate leaching, like we talked about, and then some changes in active fraction of carbon, but not, you know, we were a little disappointed, to be honest, to not see changes in total carbon. That would have been a nice find, but clearly, with the amount of below ground productivity in that roots, that's just going to be a function of time before we can find statistical differences there. And then, just in terms of our yields, you know, we can see that the total productivity of this kernza of plant in terms of the above-ground and below-ground biomass is much greater than annual wheat. But there's just, you know, obviously it just points to a breeding. We need breeding effort to partition that above that productivity to a reproductive effort. Okay, how are we doing on time, Doug? Okay, great. So I just want to, I'm not going to take too long on this, but I just want to describe another trial. This is a forage trial. that we are looking in the UP and then in East Lansing and at KBS as well, the Kellogg Station. So this was very much, it was looking at the not managing Kernza as a perennial grain, but looking at its capacity to function as a, just as a forage crop, both in alfalfa and without alfalfa. So I just mentioned before that, you know, this is a grass that's commonly planted and grazed in some of the drier regions in the Great Plains and in the West. But there hasn't been a lot of work. There's really not a lot of published information in terms of yield potential as a forage in the Midwest in some of these more mesic systems. So that was one of our main goals here. And so, you know, it's just this pretty classic forage evaluation trial of looking at intermediate wheatgrass grown with and without alfalfa. We had 12 different grasses total. So we had our orchard grass, which is essentially our check. That's clearly a commonly grown grass in Michigan as a forage crop. We had intermediate wheatgrass, so we had a number of different lines here, and then maybe a relative, or some people say it's the same species of pubescent wheatgrass, and then two different varieties of tall wheatgrass. And interestingly, well, you can see, you know, in terms of how long these different varieties have been around, it varies quite a bit. Our Kernza plant, that came from Lidahan in Kansas, and that was the same materials in the experiment I just described, this third generation. So I'm going to show the same table three times. This is biomass, and then it's ranked, basically rank order of how much you know, these plants produce. This is a sum of six different cuttings over 2 years, so it was a three cut per year system. And this is a relative forage quality. And again, well, this is actually the average of the six, but it's shown in this rank order. So I'm highlighting kind of the check here, and then our Kernza. This is an orchard grass, and then Kernza. So you can see this is the Chatham site with alfalfa. That Kernza interestingly, orchard grass did not perform very well, even though this is a commonly planted grass with an alfalfa system. It ranked lowest out of all 12 in terms of forage quality, okay? And Kernza came in a little bit lower in terms of biomass, but a little bit higher in terms of quality. Now, at the KBS site, at the Kellogg site, we can see that orchard grass ranked first in terms of total dry matter, and Kernza came in fourth. And orchard grass came in 12th again, so it was the lowest forage quality, where Kernza came in first. Okay, so there's a couple things to take home from this. One is that that depending on the variety, the site really mattered. Okay, so there's not clear differences here, or clear kind of winners or losers. The other thing is that the reason that the orchard grass is consistently lower in forage quality is that it heads sooner. We manage the system, we cut it without, you know, managing it by an alfalfa cut. And the orchard grass essentially went to head earlier, so the forage quality declined. And this is one of the reasons that we're interested in testing wheatgrass as a potential. So, and then finally, when we grew wheatgrass without it, you know, by itself as a solid stand without alfalfa, again, the dry matter was six, essentially a half, you know, the 50th percentile with orchard grass, but again, the forage quality was pretty low. So these results were kind of they were a little bit surprising to me. I think that I was expecting wheatgrass to do far worse than it actually did. Some of that was weather dependent. This experiment happened over that first year was a drought, so that was probably gave some advantage to wheatgrass. So anyways, there's a few take-home points about some of these trials. So I talked about forage quality and time of cutting. That played a role. We did some nitrogen rate manipulation and some seeding manipulation. I didn't mention this, but essentially there's not a whole lot. After that first year, there's not a big difference between manipulating seeding rate with alfalfa and wheatgrass. And then, although Kernza, I think it's interesting to just to point out that the last 12, 13 or more years of breeding kerns as a grass hasn't really reduced its competitive ability as a forage. So it just pulls us to the next kind of direction, or what, where I'm planning on taking this, which is something that Gabe mentioned and other people are interested in as well, but just using Kernza as a dual use. So we know that wheatgrass does not yield as much as our annual systems, but can we add value to that reduction in grain yield by supplementing it with a, you know, with forage? And so that's one of the things that we're interested in looking at. Can we manage it both as a perennial grain and as a forage? So we're going to be doing some manipulations of green chopping. This is kind of a simulated graze. We'd like to do this in a real grazing scenario eventually, but manipulating both timing and frequency of grazing. So that is all I have. Thank you for your attention. I'm happy to take questions.